Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting with a live studio audience from St. Louis Public Radio. Where did they go? There they are. There they are. We have lots to do and think about this hour. We've gathered members of this community to remind us all that public radio is a community, a live thinking community that gathers each day with a curiosity about world affairs to share its passions. That's our mission this hour. This is a community that has had to come together to seek peace, right? Like the Nobel Peace Prize winners, wouldn't you say? We're going to be talking about that. We're going to begin, though, with the announcement from Oslo, where the Nobel Peace Prize winner was given to the National Dialogue Quartet in Tunisia. How many of you had heard of the National Dialogue Quartet in Tunisia before today? No. We're going to hear a lot more about it now, and it's a fascinating organization that has some relevance here to this community. The Peace Prize was given for its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia in the wake of the Jasmine Revolution of 2011.
The quartet paved the way for a peaceful dialogue between the citizens, the political parties, and the authorities, and helped to find consensus-based solutions.
That's Kasi Kuhlman-Fiva, who's chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, speaking today. Join me now, a very familiar voice to all of you and to all of our listeners, Sarah Chase, senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law Program and the South Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Sarah, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, John.
So, Sarah, tell us a little bit about why the Nobel Committee awarded the prize, the Peace Prize, to this very unique model for seeking consensus in the wake of political unrest.
For me, anyway, there are a couple of really salient points. One is, these are actually four different organizations. That's why it's called a quartet. It's the main labor union, and we're talking old-fashioned, left-leaning, big labor, right? 20% of the Tunisian population belongs to the labor union. The employers union, it's the equivalent of, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, the Bar Association, and the Human Rights League. So these four organizations came together, and I think the first really interesting point is they had to make peace internally, in particular management and labor, right? I mean, these are two organizations that basically exist in order to be in conflict with each other. That's what they're there for. And these two had not been on the same side of an issue since Tunisia's fight for independence from France. So that, I think, is really remarkable, and it's a kind of leading by example, if you will.
Let me read a little bit of what the Nobel statement said today, and it echoes what you've said there, and it really kind of gives me goosebumps and a sense of hope that we can achieve change in a tangible way. The quartet paved the way, the Nobel Committee said, for the peaceful dialogue between the citizens, the political parties, and the authorities. It helped to find consensus-based solutions to a wide range of challenges across political and religious divides. The broad-based national dialogue that the quartet succeeded in establishing countered the spread of violence in Tunisia, which, as you know, Sarah, is very prone to that violence, and it's been happening since independence from France, as you alluded to. Its function, the quartet's function, the Nobel Committee said, is therefore comparable to that of the peace congresses to which Alfred Nobel refers to explicitly in his will. This seems to be absolutely the sweet spot of the Peace Prize in terms of its mission.
And I think there's a second piece of that. Now, obviously, every Nobel laureate, you know, has shed blood, sweat, and tears in his or her efforts to promote the cause of peace. In this particular case, and I had been going to Tunisia very, very frequently since the revolution and spent some time researching. I wasn't there during the period that's really being highlighted here, but right afterwards, I did significant research into how the quartet had actually done this. And what I found was just they rolled up their sleeves and knocked some heads together, figuratively, not literally. literally, I mean, the number of all-nighters that were pulled, the effort in particular that the head of the labor union underwent to try to teach politicians how to negotiate. Because, again, one thing that management and labor know how to do usually is negotiate. But these were neophyte politicians. These guys had been in jail or they'd been in exile, and they literally didn't know much about the techniques of negotiating. And gosh, the number of times that this process almost went off the rails, the number of times that people were being recalcitrant, and just the persistence and almost bloody-mindedness of the leadership of these four organizations in forcing these negotiations forward was really remarkable.
Sarah, what did your research tell you about how the nation, and I spent a lot of time reporting from Tunisia years ago, and there was this sense, and it's true of all the nations in North Africa, a sense of cynicism about the government, whether anything can change, whether anything can happen. How did the quartet seem to engage the national consensus of people on the street? How is that reflected in your research?
Well, I would say that we were talking about a different period here, right? This is 2013. It's after there's been a revolution, which kind of broke with all of that cynicism, produced a completely new environment, but it had kind of ground to a halt. Remember, this is 2013 when in almost neighboring Egypt, you have a coup. So you've got two countries that kind of go through a very similar process where you've got kind of anti-authoritarian and anti-corruption, if I may, revolution, followed by an electoral process where an Islamist political party comes to power in both of those countries, right? And in both cases, I would say the Islamist party was largely governing for itself and its followers and was starting to develop constitutional provisions and things like that that were quite exclusive. And what happened in Egypt was a coup, a military coup, followed by, you know, a massacre, frankly, of supporters of this Islamist party in the streets of Cairo, right? That's the same summer. In Tunisia, you had not as dramatic, but a similar sense of rising crisis. You had had several political assassinations, which were committed likely by the radical fringe of the Islamist community, if you will, in Tunisia. And that was unheard of in Tunisia, to have, you know, respected politicians gunned down in the streets. That was, and so those assassinations were followed in every case by massive demonstrations, by, you know, in one case, at least a general strike. And then by the summer, what you had was parliamentarians who were so concerned about the direction that things were taking, and in particular the writing of the Constitution, that they basically walked out of the National Assembly and started camping out outside. So in fact, I think the environment for this was quite different from the one that you experienced. It was very galvanized, a lot of citizen engagement and involvement. But as you know, kind of popular movements on the street don't often arrive at complex political settlements.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Sarah Chase from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.